Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody, along with my co-host, Dr. Pettis Perry. How are things going today with you, Pettis?
Things are going well today, Jill. Thank you. I'm really happy to be back with you. April was a long, difficult month, but I'm glad it's over and we're up and running again.
I'm glad you're back with us, too. I missed you.
Well, thank you. I missed you, too. I did listen, though.
Oh, good. Thank you. Well, for me, right now, today, my head is exploding over Alito's monstrous reasoning and his leaked decision creating what I would call government-forced pregnancy. You know, the party that doesn't want government in your life is now creating government-forced pregnancy, and thus, in my view, women's bodies becoming the property of the state. I just don't know what man would ever stand for this violation of his body. You don't have to answer that unless you want to. I'm just letting off some steam.
Well, that's okay, but you know, I can tell you there is no man that would stand for that. You know, what's going on, Jill, as we talk about fairly regularly, is we continue to see this naked abuse of power. You know, and in this case, it continues to be minority rule over the wishes of the majority and the intrusion of religion and cultism in our legal and political discourse. You know, we're witnessing the effects of the manipulation of policies and practices by one group to maintain control over another while governing. You know, but those things aside, you know, we've got a show to do. And I think we're going to be talking more fully about this in an upcoming show, or at least I hope we will be.
Well, just to add on to what you're talking about power, most people don't know who Vice President Henry Wallace was, but he was our 33rd Vice President. He was once a Republican and then became a Democrat. And he was talking about the Republicans that they are patriotic in time of war because it is to their interest to do so. But in time of peace, they follow power and the dollar wherever it may lead. So just, you know, you were talking about power, and it's nothing new, I guess, but now it's got control of the Supreme Court. But you're right, we have a show, and I'm going to rant a little bit more later, but we have a show to get to, and we have some very special guests to meet. Our program today is, Will There Ever Be Equality for Mothers? The word title alludes to water. More importantly, though, it connotes a movement caused by disruptions from below. Title equality is about expanding equity and inclusion by expanding democratic decision-making. Co-CEOs and co-founders, Dr. Kristen Leash and Anna Dewar-Gully, work to help organizations reduce and solve for inequities of all kinds. As mothers, they have observed how those inequities differ among mothers from a variety of identities, backgrounds, and lived experiences. Our guests will share their landmark methodology, the equity sequence, which can help invite equity-seeking individuals from a variety of backgrounds, including mothers and parents, into the design of workplace decisions that work better for all. Our future depends on it. And Pettis, to you, would you like to introduce our guest today?
Certainly. And by the way, I did sign up for their program, and I'm going through it myself.
Oh, the equity sequence?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, good for you. You get a gold star.
Well, thank you. And I do want to wish, you know, all of our women today on the show, as well as those in the audience, happy Mother's Day. We really do salute you. Without you, none of us would be here.
You got that right.
You know, we have two really special guests from Canada today, and they're both highly focused on the U.S. Because many of their clients are in the States. Dr. Kristen Leash is the CEO and co-founder of Title Equality, named a Forbes Diversity and Inclusion Trailblazer. Congratulations, Kristen. And she's a strategist and educator with experience designing transformative curricula, implementing equitable process, change processes, and capacity building programs to support the design of more equitable organizations in Canada, the U.S., Europe, and New Zealand. Welcome to Be Bold America, Dr. Leash.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're with us from Victoria, Canada. Thank correct. You. Yay.
I love Victoria. It's
oh,
a
I do too.
Place.
And you live near there, don't you, Pat?
I do, and I've been there several times.
Wonderful.
I'm glad the borders are back open.
So bet.
We can start traveling again. Our next guest is Anna Dewar-Gully, who is co-CEO and co-founder of Title Equality. Anna is an organizational strategist with experience designing enterprise-wide strategy, advising boards and leading on governance, spearheading transformation initiatives, and building greater equality in large systems and organizations in Canada, the U.S., Europe, and the U.K. Welcome to Be Bold America, Anna. Are you with us from Toronto today, or where are you at today?
I am in Toronto, Dr. Perry. Nice to be with you.
Oh, please call me Pettis. I love Toronto. My son and I have spent time up there. He played his juniors hockey up in northern Ontario in Elliott Lake. So I love
oh,
that
wow.
area.
Oh, wow, Elliott Lake. No way.
Elliott Lake. Yep, and North Bay, actually.
Wow.
So, you know, thank you both for joining us on this this Mother's Day. And please thank your families as well for letting you spend some time with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Yes, happy Mother's Day, Kristen and Anna. So I know before we begin talking about what Title Equality is and does, and I need to rant for a moment and then get your Canadian perspective, if that's all right.
You bet.
We love a good rant.
Oh, good.
Go for it.
Go for it. So this week we had quite a shock in the United States. And the leaked draft decision from the U.S. Supreme Court referencing its basis for their decision, an English barrister from the 1600s, Sir Matthew Hale, this was in the decision, who was a huge advocate for marital rape. He believed that women's bodies belonged to men and women were not autonomous beings. It also, this draft Supreme Court decision also referenced a judge back in the 1700s also, who was a witch hunter and put witches to death. And before this draft Supreme Court decision was leaked, we had titled this show, Will There Ever Be Equality for Mothers? And at this moment, I feel the answer is, here in the United States, a resounding no. Mm-hmm. For mothers and all women. On your website, it says, inequality is at the root of your challenges. We just got a lot more unequal in the States, and I know many of your clients live in the States. Do you have any reactions to our Supreme Court's draft decision that will become law from a mother's perspective, a woman's perspective, a Canadian's perspective? Mm-hmm. Dr. Leash, are you a brave soul to take that on right now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's you know, many folks in the pro-choice movement have been saying this is no surprise. We've seen this coming for a long time. And yet, every single time rights like these get chipped away, it continues to point to the extent to which the control over women's bodies and women's choices is a priority for some in government. And at the end of the day, any person who has become a mother by choice or otherwise knows that this, you know, I've got two lovely kids that I very much decided to have, and yet it is the hardest job I've ever taken on. And so we all know that by, like you mentioned in the intro, forcing parenthood on individuals is absolutely going to exacerbate the existing inequities we have in society and is disproportionately going to unduly burden the lives of so many women in so many communities and their families. And I think it is such a brazen act of control, and to speak to what you were saying earlier around power, it is nothing other than an act of power and exertion of control over so many people's bodies and lives and livelihoods, and there really is no other explanation for it when you get down to it.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't echo what you said more. And I also, you know, I think if we're going to base the future on the past, we don't have a lot of hope for building a more equitable society. You know, I think our society has slowly been pulling itself out of horrifically unequal circumstances for time immemorial. And I think what scares me most about this decision is it's anchoring in, you know, at such a time that I hoped had gone gone by. That clearly has not. And I just to underscore Kristen's point about the effect that it will have on, you know, certain communities. You know, I think if you're a person in society that has access to means, has access to financial resources, has access to come up to Canada where we are, you know, if an abortion is required, I think of people who are living in poverty, who are living in difficult, violent relationships or relationships where they do not have choice over their own bodies. And I think about, you know, already marginalized, otherwise marginalized communities who this is going to affect even more deeply than it will affect, you know, folks that have more access to choice and opportunity. And so I just think this is a pretty universal loss for equality. And I think it's one example of an issue where it absolutely requires many different intersecting groups, all of whom care about inequality, getting together, working together, standing together to make a change.
Well, Kristen mentioned that it's not a surprise, and it's not a surprise, but it's still shocking once one reads the draft decision and see that it is built on people from the 1600s. We're not going back 50 years. We're going back hundreds of years to basis that women are not even autonomous beings. Yeah. And witch hunters. I mean, that's the shocking part, is that women aren't even people. And we can't have any control over our own bodies or decision making. So I remember when my mother couldn't have a credit card on her own without my dad's signature. That was just 1974.
Yeah.
And I guess this is going back much farther than that. So it's shocking. And also, it's been in place for 49 years. So every woman, young woman of childbearing age, every girl born in the United States, hasn't been raised in a world without it. Yeah. They don't know that what that right was like when they got it, and now they're going to know what it's like being taken away. And my stomach hurts.
Yeah, I think ours have been hurting too. I know this is an issue. We have American team members, and frankly, you know, as Canadians, although we are a very different society, it does feel very close. And I think, you know, we see some of the same threads emerging in some of our political discourse here, you know, in different ways. I think this decision being taken in the U.S. does have worldwide ramifications for women's rights, and it's you know, very, you're right. I think that the nature of the decision itself is shocking. And I think the rationale for the decision is shocking. And I think we all need to stay shocked. I think it's essential that we don't get complacent about this kind of a decision and its impact and ramifications. And I think it's time, honestly, for the feminist movement to reawaken because, you know, women's rights are not guaranteed, obviously. I think that's something that we've all been horribly reminded of this Mother's Day week.
Oh, well, I'm just, when I think about it, I'm speechless, especially because many of the points he made in this draft decision are violation of the Constitution, but there's no way to appeal. You know, who do you appeal to? Anyway, one thing I did want to say is that I did live in Canada. I went to the University of Alberta in Edmonton for a little while. I loved rediscovering the candy counter up there, trying to... It was, you may have had different candies, and my husband and I, Jerry, we honeymooned at Niagara Falls and visited Toronto, Anna.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, yeah. You know that Kristen actually went to U of A for her undergrad too.
So really?
Yeah. And all so the we're shared alum there. There.
Yeah. Yay. Yay, U of A. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org. We're speaking with Dr. Kristen Leash and Anna Dewar-Gully, co-CEOs and co-founders of Tidal Equality. Tidal Equality helps organizations solve the problem of inequality at scale in innovative ways. Visit TitleEquality.com to learn more. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. I'm Tom Hartman, and each weekday at 4 p.m., I bring you a different perspective on the news than you're likely to hear on most media outlets. Please join me on KSQD Santa Cruz, your ink spot on the dial for the Tom Hartman program. Heard now for the first time ever in the Monterey Bay Area at 90.7 FM. Weekdays at 4 p.m. That's Progressive Talking Conversation with me, Tom Hartman. Weekdays at 4 p.m. on KSQD 90.7 FM. Tag, you're it.
If you're just joining us, we're listening to our two bold guests, Dr. Kristen Leash and Anna Dewar-Gully, co-CEOs and co-founders of Title Equality. And also, I want to let you know, both know that I'm going to be asking questions for a while, and I'm going to hand it over to Pettis. We thought that might be the best way because of our different focuses on questions. So just so that everyone knows that I'm not forgetting Pettis, he's going to have his time. And just to get started, it's Mother's Day. What effect did balancing work and being a mother have on you personally, Kristen, Anna? We can start with Kristen. In your own evolution of equality and equity champions?
Thanks for that question, Jill. I mean, I dare say the word balance is not something I often feel like I truly achieve when it comes to
it's a goal.
Motherhood, right, and work. But it really was at that intersection that created a turning point for me in my career and eventually brought me together with Anna. And it was I was doing my postgraduate, a PhD in literature, actually, of all things. But I was actually studying the work and lives of women at the turn of the 20th century, you know, very early feminists, abolitionists, people fighting for gay rights, women's rights, and so on at the time, very early on. And I had just had my daughter as well, my first child. And so in one hand, I was holding the correspondence of these early feminists. And the other hand, I have my infant. I'm burping her on my shoulder. But I had this moment where the writing of those women at the turn of the 20th century resonated far too much with me. The things that they were writing reminded me of conversations I was having with other women, with other mothers, with other academics, and so on, and with the discourse of equality champions today. And when I looked down at my daughter, I thought, you know, this just can't be her story too. And it was a moment when I realized I really, whatever it was that I was going to do next, it had to be around pursuing a change in this narrative and going about finding new ways to accelerate the pace of change. Because as we're going to discuss today, and as that experience showed me, far too little has changed over far too many years. And as, you know, we started this conversation with the leaked decision, we also know that no change can be guaranteed. And it needs to be a constant, vigilant fight for the maintenance of the rights that we do achieve as women and as mothers. And so that really kind of sums up what spurs me on, gets me out of bed and up at night every night too, with my children, you know, dancing around my feet. So,
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I think the journey into motherhood for me was an eye reopener. I think I've always, I think partly because of my character and my personality, I'm a very kind of outspoken, ambitious human. And I think I've experienced various forms of gender inequity throughout my life for lots of different complex intersecting reasons. But when I became a mother, especially the first time, I had to make a decision about a promotion that I was sort of, you know, my name was put forward for. And I remember thinking, you know, do I disclose that I'm pregnant now that I'm being put forward for this promotion? This is a promotion that had been kind of dangled in front of me for, at that point, probably 2 years. You know, it was sort of had my name all over it. And I thought, if I, you know, announce that I'm pregnant right now, I'm probably not going to get that promotion. I knew I was up against two men. And what I felt in that particular moment was just, I just felt completely alone. I felt completely unguided. I felt like I had absolutely no idea who I could trust or turn to in the organization I worked for at the time to sort of say, this is what I'm dealing with, you know, how do I navigate this scenario? And I felt this huge amount of pressure to kind of do the right thing in kind of every direction, which I think is, you know, a reality of motherhood in the workplace. You know, you're trying so hard to kind of do right by your family, you're trying so hard to do right by your work or your employer, or your organization, and by your colleagues, and you kind of walk into this quagmire of interests that you need to somehow balance. And in my experience, the time that I first became a mother, you know, almost 11 years ago, I felt like I was very unscaffolded, and it became an issue of real concern for me. And I started to notice just how many women around me were struggling with various versions of that problem. And, you know, it's been a kind of curiosity and a concern of mine ever since.
Well, I certainly identify when you talk about feeling alone. I'm older. I started my career in the late, my full-time career in the, well, I guess it'd be the early 70s. I had my son in 1982, and I was the first woman manager in a city here in the Bay Area. I was the very first woman manager in the late 70s. So they weren't used to women being in management positions. When I had my son, I didn't know till I got back. I was lucky to have that the town clerk was an elected office of this city, and was a woman. And when I came back, she told me that the city manager had walked over to her, and I was on my leave for the birth and to be home with the baby for a while. And the town manager walked over to her and said, cancel her benefits. And she goes, I can't do that. She's going to have a baby. He said, well, she's not working. Cancel her benefits. And if it wasn't for the protection of that woman in that position, I may have been gone to the hospital to have a child and have no health care coverage.
Yeah.
So,
and I think the truth is, Jill, like people still are playing roles like that.
For yes.
Place, right. I mean, like even where there are protections, there are still, I mean, I can't tell you how many women I've helped navigate a layoff during a pregnancy, you know, where it was obvious that that person had been laid off because they were pregnant. And yet, you know, it was done under the cover of, you know, some broader decision, and it was an opportune moment to get rid of someone before a maternity leave. But I mean, these are problems that I feel like I wish I could say they've evolved a lot, but I really don't. I don't think that they have. You know, I think there are more policies in place, there are more leaves, but that has created a whole new knock-on set of problems, especially in regressive organizations that just don't want to have to manage those leaves. You know, so it really is unfortunate that these problems, you know, like Kristen said, you know, feel so familiar over time.
Yes. And I also felt at the time that for those months I wasn't working, I wasn't earning my credit towards my pension, but men were. So right. They were 6 months ahead of me. And yep. So I would think it's still the same, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It is the same. I mean, I know that, you know, when you look at the pay gap and what accounts for the pay gap, I mean, it starts pretty much right out of school, but then it accelerates through maternity leaves, right? It accelerates because if you're in an organization with a bonus structure, your bonus probably isn't going to keep up with your male counterparts. You know, if you've got, you know, pension contribution, all of that, there are so many variables in that, but it remains a very important reality for working women today.
Tragically.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Dr. Kristen Leash and Anna Duergully, co-CEOs and co-founders of Title Equality. Title Equality helps organizations solve the problem of inequality at scale in innovative ways. Visit TitleEquality.com to learn more. Pettis and I would like to add you to our news group, and you may do so by texting Be Bold America at 22828. Text Be Bold America to 22828. Our list is growing. I love seeing those names being added to the list. We appreciate each and every one of you. We'll be right back with our two bold guests right after this week's Hightower Commentary, where Jim remarks on the sad whine of the Supreme Court right. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Ralph Waldo Emerson told about a guest who came to dinner and spent the entire evening prattling about his own integrity. The louder he talked of his honor, Emerson wrote, the faster we counted our spoons. Today, America has not one but six guests in our national home babbling about their integrity. They are the six extremist Republican judges who now control our Supreme Court, and it's a bit unsettling to hear them go on and on, almost frantically pleading with us to believe in their judicial impartiality. For example, the court's newest member, Amy Coney Barrett, suddenly blurted out at a public forum in September that, quote, "this court is not comprised of a bunch of partisan hacks." Whoa, better count our spoons. In fact, each of the six were installed on the court by right-wing Republicans specifically because they had proven to be devout partisan hacks. Interestingly, Barrett made her unprompted and strained assertion of judicial integrity at the McConnell Center, named for Mitch McConnell, the rabidly partisan GOP senator who pulled a fast one last year, rushing Barrett onto the bench on a party-line vote just before the Republicans lost control of the Senate. Indeed, old Mitch himself introduced Barrett at the forum where she gave her "We Are Not Partisan Hacks" speech. He grinned proudly at the pure hackery of his partisan protege. This is Jim Hightower saying, another hardcore partisan on the court, Sam Alito, whined in October that critics accused the court's GOP majority of being, quote, "a dangerous cabal that resorts to sneaky and improper methods to get its way." Well, golly, Sam, yes, we do think that. Because again and again, you partisans sneak up on the Constitution and we the people to twist the law to fit your political bias and personal whims. If you don't want to be considered political hacks, stop being political hacks. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org website. Our topic today is, will there ever be equality for mothers? And we're speaking with Dr. Kristen Leash and Anna Dewar-Gully, co-CEOs and co-founders of Title Equality. And now, Pettis, I think it's your turn.
Well, thank you. This has been a very interesting discussion thus far. I want to just make a couple of comments based on the things that the three of you have been discussing. One is that Jill's comment was about women are not people, yet corporations are, which is one of the things that turns my stomach the most. And the issue of women being able to cross borders to be able to seek an abortion is being undermined in some states by making it illegal for them to do that and threatening prosecution if they do that and then come back to that particular state.
And become prisoners of their state.
Yes. And it's so they're really, this really is going back to a medieval time. Unfortunately, in our society, I just want to acknowledge those things. And Anna, you spoke about not knowing who to turn to. In my work with organizations, that's a signal, at least in part, that there isn't a culture of trust in which people do know who to go to, not just for women's issues, but anyone that's having any particular difficulty in terms of trying to get advice to work through the issues that they're confronting. And it all breaks my heart. I'm very empathetic to the issues that you and all women face in the workforce. We are in a vehicle in reverse, and it's something that we have to really work through. The other thing I just want to point out is one of the problems that I run into, and I'll just talk about my own work, is that we do so much parsing based on socially categorized groupings of people. It's a divide and conquer situation. So, for example, we're talking about women's rights, but these are family rights. And when we start bringing the family in, we begin to also bring in men. And I'm not talking about the work that you guys are doing. I'm talking about the way that people are forced to talk about the things that they're confronting in the workplace. So we exclude by parsing rather than finding ways to really include more people in the discussion. Do either of you or both of you have any thoughts about what I'm saying?
Yeah, I could not agree with you more, Pettis. I think that kind of division that occurs amongst folks that care about equity, I think, is one of the most powerful inhibitors of real change in organizations and in our society writ large. And it's kind of a force that I feel like Kristen and I constantly contend with in our work, wrestle with at times in our work, because I think it would be great for status quo power structures to have everyone who cares for a more equitable, inclusive, just world to just divide and conquer each other, you know? And so I think you're right. You know, the idea of talking about family rights is crucial. The idea about talking about the kinds of workplaces and organizations that exist today and why they're bettered by women and why women's rights are rights that all organizations, all communities need to be fighting for connectedly, you know? And then all of us together thinking about who are the most vulnerable folks in our society that we can also bring the voices to the table of and center as we're working together and being collaborative. But one of the things we talk about more than we talk about anything else is how we find that point of intersection or that common cause so that we can kind of stand arm in arm and make change. Because I feel like what happens when we don't, when we allow ourselves to be siloed or polarized or whatever, is you know, the powerful, unethical forces in our society and our organizations win.
Pettis, if I may dovetail onto that question, what is Title Equality's approach towards expanding democratic decision making?
Kristen?
Well, to kind of think back to what you both alluded to earlier about the fact that, you know, this decision around abortion rights is made by a very, very small and homogeneous group of people. It does not represent the perspectives of the majority, and yet the decision is one that will impact so many who do not share that perspective. You know, across the U.S., the majority of people believe in access to abortion, at least under some conditions. And so in any given organization, by and large, unless equitable and inclusive decision-making is woven into the fabric of that organization, it tends to be that very few people and homogeneous groups of people hold decision-making power, and they make decisions on behalf of large groups of people, be they their own staff and employee population, or for the very many, many people organizations serve out there in the world. And so our goal is in an organization is really to both demonstrate as well as equip individuals to see how and where they can expand decision-making, how they can bring voices to the decision-making process in ways that doesn't just create a context for inclusive innovation, but also representative decision making that can be to the benefit of the people in the organization and to the people that organization serves. Because it's really only when we have that multiplicity of voices can we make the best decisions as individuals, as teams, as groups. Anna?
Yeah, and I'll say, like, you know, just to make that concrete, we have two methodologies. One is called Equity Sequence, one is called a Wave. An equity sequence is a system of questions about a thing, a decision, a design, a process, a system. Everyday decisions that you make in an organization, you can apply equity sequence to. And what you learn when you learn equity sequence is how often critical decisions and sometimes less critical decisions are made by that homogenous population too often. Sometimes that may just look like you, like you're the only person working on an HR policy that affects the whole organization, and you only bring one vantage point. So what equity sequence helps an individual and an organization see is who's missing, whose voices, whose perspectives, whose ideas are missing from decision-making, and it encourages you to invite those perspectives and ideas in. And a wave is a strategic planning or a strategy creation methodology that's all about democratizing who gets to shape strategy. So in most organizations, strategy is created, to Kristen's point, by usually an elite homogenous group of people on behalf of everybody, both customers, employees, stakeholders alike. Our WAVE process is a way of getting into the world in an organization and saying, what's the problem to everybody? What's the opportunity to everyone? And how do we, you know, where do we go from here? And making that a collective decision-making process, a collaborative decision-making process, democratizing the development of strategy in an organization. So those are the two concrete ways we do that in our work.
Oh, thank you. Pettis?
Thanks, Jill. Yeah, typically strategic planning processes are top down, and it's something that I struggle with as well in the work that I do in trying to change those sorts of paradigms for the reasons that you spoke about and others. I want to stick with this abortion conversation, if I might. I was looking at something from Planned Parenthood. I think I got it off of your site. If not, I picked it up outside. But it's the statement says, in sum, no amount of controversy over abortion can negate the evidence that American women, men, children, and families have reaped great benefits to their physical, mental, and social health from the U.S. Supreme Court's historic decision in Roe v. Wade. Any erosion of a woman's right and access to medically safe, legal abortion jeopardizes the health of women, their families, and the nation as a whole. So I think it encapsulates kind of the points that we're making. So I have a question for you both. What might a conversation with members of the Supreme Court look like using the title equity system in their decision-making process? And I want to come back to another question after you address that.
So I would love to address that. I think, you know, I sort of alluded to it in my opening remarks about the draft decision. And that's that, you know, relying on history as the context for the future will create more and greater inequity. Because if you think about, you know, to the way that Jill described who was being quoted in terms of the decision makers to shape and articulate that draft decision, what we're talking about here are men from centuries ago who lived in a society that was woefully unequal on so many different dimensions. And, you know, basing tomorrow on that thinking is really a recipe for inequity. So what would the equity sequence show you? It would show you who those decisions were designed by, for, with, and without. And it would help you understand why, if we want to build a society that truly is progressing towards more rights, more freedoms, more liberties, and frankly, more prosperity, we cannot be looking to rest you know, all future decisions on the shoulders of so-called giants, because those giants, unfortunately, had biases deeper than those that exist today, shaped by their unequal societies around them. So I think what equity sequence would reveal to people open to learning sitting around the Supreme Court would be that, you know, we need to look at the society we're in today, the needs of the humans, you know, in the electorate today, the wants of the electorate today. Because my understanding of the Supreme Court is that this is also a deviation in terms of going against the will of the people. You know, I've heard some commentary here in Canada, I don't know how it's being covered in the U.S., about how unprecedented it is in the nature of the decision itself to talk about this being against popular will, you know, and not caring that it's against popular will. So, you know, this is an anti-democratic decision. Equity sequence is a democratic process. I think, you know, in using it in that context, you would see the stark contrast between one and the other.
Absolutely. The latest poll I saw was 80% of the population feels that some sort of abortion rights ability, they support that perspective. Was that Anna or Kristen that just spoke?
That was Anna. Yeah.
Kristen, do you have any thoughts to add to that?
Well, I can't help but think there's a bit of a contrast here to what was just recently announced in Afghanistan, which was the reintroduction of the burqa as law. And I know that, you know, here we have what would ostensibly be two very different countries and people who believe they have very different ways of making decisions and guiding people's bodies and rights and freedoms, and yet they're not so far different at the moment. And again, coming back to the question of who is sitting around the table making decisions on behalf of enormous swaths of the population, and as you rightly point out, that completely contradicts the actual will of that population in the decision making. And to me, where we must ask the question is, to what end do we control this number of people? It is, you know, shown throughout history that governments and systems of power that wish to become more authoritarian, they do so by way of reducing and minimizing the rights of women first. Because it is when women are fully participatory in civic life, in determining their futures, and in what they do with themselves, that it is very difficult for authoritarianism to achieve a stronghold. And so it's that is exactly where authoritarian aims take their first shot, is at women's rights and women's freedoms. And so, yes, this is absolutely a question around women's rights to determine their own reproductive future and health care. And the question remains, to what end is this being pursued with such fervor?
I think you've answered that question quite well. I know Jill and I talk about the authoritarian nature of a small percentage of our population who happen to be in majority control. Jill, do I have time for another question?
Yes, uh-huh. You do.
Okay, as I was going through your site, I happened upon a great one-hour discussion that you were having about bell hooks. Hmm. Can you tell us about bell hooks? Who she was, what her theory was, and then what she might have to say about this Supreme Court decision?
Oh, gosh, thank you for bringing that up, Pettis, and I'm glad you had the opportunity to see this. I mean, many will know that bell hooks was, she was an academic, she was a writer, she was, a poet in some ways, and a feminist activist for many, many years, and she passed away last year, sadly. And she had an idea around how it was that we could pursue a more equitable and inclusive society, and that was through a love ethic. And, you know, we don't often talk about social justice work and the word love in the same sentence, because oftentimes it feels like a battle. But Bell took this approach, believing that to achieve equality, we really needed to see the work that we do through love for one another. And this doesn't mean the kind of love that is absent righteous indignation or that is permissive of all kinds of behavior, but that actually tries to approach the work of empathizing with one another, with people who are different from us, through a lens that requires some work, some empathy, a pursuit of knowledge, understanding, respect, kindness, and care. And it is, you know, knowing that that is something that Bell fought for in her life and her life's work and through her discourse, she, and I am not going to, you know, put words in her mouth by any means, but it is the decision that we're seeing today is absolutely contrary to anything remotely resembling a love ethic. And so, you know, I know many social justice activists and advocates who are very disheartened at the moment by exactly how uncaring, unkind, unloving is this decision. And I think if we were to look at this decision through the love ethic, it could also present the opportunity to create those bridges of common cause across groups that today may see themselves at odds behind this decision. It really is a radical perspective on seeking equity for groups and individuals, and I absolutely encourage anyone to take a look at Bell Hooks' work on that matter.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with our two bold guests, Dr. Kristen Leash and Anna Dewar Gully, co-CEOs and co-founders of Title Equality. Title Equality helps organizations solve the problem of inequality at scale in innovative ways. Visit TitleEquality.com to learn more. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Join KSQD tonight at 6 p.m. for Intersections, hosted by Seth Shapiro. Intersections takes you to the crossroads of ideas, mapping the contours of belief and knowledge through the stories and lives of influential voices. Meet notable people in diverse fields who are asking important questions. Their experiences and perspectives challenge us to pursue lives of meaning and purpose. Tune into Intersections, Sunday evening at 6 p.m., KSQD, 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Many voices, one station.
You are listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Want a friend to hear this interview? Well, I hope so. Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you and your friends may listen from your favorite podcast platform, such as Apple, Google, Spotify, Radio Public, and many more. You can subscribe for free. And before we move on to our keep, stop, start portion of this program, Kristen and Anna, there must be things that you wanted to talk about that we didn't cover, and I wanted to make sure that you were able to speak more about the things that you wanted to share with us before we went into our what listeners can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing.
Okay, I mean, I'll take that. It's Anna. I think, first of all, I think this has been an incredibly rich conversation, and I thank you both for the questions that you've asked and the ideas you've shared. I think if there's one thing I want people to start thinking about as they go into their kind of everyday work in organizations of all shapes and sizes and of all types, you know, here, there, and everywhere, it's the extent to which your everyday decisions present powerful opportunities to contribute to outcomes that don't look like this new decision regarding abortion, that look like a better, kinder, more loving world. I think, you know, there are times, especially times like these, where we have these kind of horrific circumstances shaping our perception about what's possible in the world, when things feel impossible in the world because we're faced with a new obstacle that feels insurmountable in the pursuit of a more equitable, just society. And I think it's in those moments that all of us have a duty to look around us, to look at the work that we do every single day, to think about the span of control you hold, whether that's a large span of control or seemingly small, and to think about using the decisions that you make every day to make more equitable change, a more just society. Because our organizations are instruments for social change, and our work is an instrument for social change. And I think, you know, it's all of us, you know, working at that fabric that is going to create that opportunity for the society that I think the vast majority of us wish to be a part of. And that's one where we really do consider needs different than our own. We really do try to shape our society sensitively and with empathy and with care and concern for people that have needs that look like ours, don't look like ours, you know, and realities different and the same. And so I think, you know, as you're listening and if you're feeling that sense of just overwhelm that I think so many people are suffering from in the wake of the news on this decision from the Supreme Court, I urge you to pause, to look around and get down to work, making change where you can, and to locking arms where you can. And I think, you know, our work a title is very much about that. It's about unlocking that power and potential in people and in organizations, but you don't need us to do that. You can look at the work that you're doing tomorrow all by yourself and think, how can I use this as a vehicle for growing greater equity and humanity in this world? And I hope you do that.
Well, Anna, to dovetail on what you're saying about a better, kinder, more loving world, one of my concerns, deep concerns, is the message that this decision over years will start sending to young men in our society. We've spent nearly 50 years working with building more equality between men and women. And subtly, and maybe not so subtly, young boys are going to be getting the message from society that women are second-class citizens. They can't leave their state. They have to have government forced pregnancies. The thought of Sir Matthew Hale being women aren't even autonomous beings. I'm very concerned about how that's going to affect, in the long term, how men and young men are going to start seeing the girls and women in their lives. And I think we also need to realize that we need to teach, as mothers, need to teach men growing up, young boys growing up, that even though there's this inequality in our society as a system, in reality, we're still equal. And Kristen, did you have any last minute what you wanted to say before we went to Keep, Stop, Start?
I mean, just to the point that you just raised, you know, we live in an era where, you know, when polled, millennial men, for example, you know, claim the term feminist for themselves at rates that we've never seen before. And yet, you know, when it comes down to domestic labor, for example, the balance has not really changed from the previous generation. And I think that now for all of those men who do consider themselves feminists, it is absolutely time for them to put feet to the ground in this regard, because as you know, women, I think, have been trying to raise their children in ways that aim for more equitable scenarios and relationships in the workplace and so on. And I think we need to have men activated in these roles to see and hopefully see the risk that these decisions have to their lives and livelihoods as well. I mean, it's no surprise that, you know, in times of recession, the popularity of abortion rights go up because it is a difficult time for families, in particular when, you know, the right to choose and determine your family's future is taken away. But all that to say, again, I think we cannot sit on our laurels, and it cannot be done by just half the population. We need everybody who believes in the right of a person to be autonomous over their body and their health care to be fighting for that right. Because as I'm sure you and many of your listeners know, the right to abortion is not the only right that hinges on Roe. We have the right to interracial marriage, the right to contraception, the right to gay marriage. These things hinge on Roe and could therefore be up for grabs. And I think there are many, many people who care also about those rights who should be activated in this moment to do whatever they can to create a political impact as a result of this decision.
Well, you can see in the decision that it's actually written to bastardized thought process to create this decision is set up to be able to attack contraception and mixed race marriages. That's sort of set up, even though it says it won't. But they're not trustworthy in the first place, so you can't believe that.
It's a slippery mountain, not a slippery slope.
Exactly. Now, Pettis, did you have any thoughts before we go into Keep, Stop, Start?
No, why don't you go into that? I want to give them enough time.
Okay.
If there's time at the end, maybe I can ask one more question.
Okay, good. So, Kristen, Anna, what should our listeners, what should we keep doing to promote your message and your mission?
What should you keep doing?
Yeah.
Listeners should keep looking at their everyday work and decision-making as an opportunity to make change and to make it sincerely and to make it with the broadest possible consultation in their organization. So if you're sitting around a table in your work every day making unilateral decisions, see how much democracy you can bring to that decision making. See how many different voices, people of different identities, perspectives, backgrounds you can bring to your table to help you shape something better for the people that you serve. I think that's what we need to keep doing. And I think when it comes to dealing with issues like Roe, I think you need to get out on the streets. And I think we all need to get out on the streets and protest.
And in terms of stop, I mean, it's really an attitude thing in this regard. I think many of us, as Anna alluded to earlier, feel in light of a decision like this that we are powerless. But the fact is, every decision we make every day either upholds the status quo, which is demonstrated to be inequitable and unequal, or it can be an opportunity to throw a wrench in the works to, as Anna said, bring in diverse voices and diverse perspectives and democratize decision making, because that will disrupt the status quo. And the fact is, you know, research shows it only takes a committed minority of 25% of people to shift social norms. to go from saying it's okay that we only have a few people who represent a very tiny slice of the population making decisions on behalf of the many, to making that socially unacceptable. And so I would encourage listeners to stop feeling like their everyday decisions are inconsequential, because they actually model in every decision and any greater democratic decision they make a way to do things differently from how they're being done today. Anna, do you have an idea for start?
I would say start by figuring out what you stand for on these issues, and start asking your colleagues, your peers, your neighbors, and your friends what they stand for, and find common cause at the intersection between those interest groups. Get organized and get moving.
Well, I'd like to add a stop, and that is that we have to stop feeling, and I think you were touching on this, Kristen, feeling stressed and overwhelmed about this, because that's what they want. That's how they win.
Yeah.
They want you to give up. There is so much bombardment and input from so many directions, and it's well-funded. Many think tanks, lots of money to bombard us so that we just give up, have apathy. And they know they win that way as soon as we do that. So I know we're stressed, but we have to keep carving out the time to call our representatives. I did that the very next day. Call our representatives, our senators, and our congress members, and also send postcards. Not letters, by the way. They still go through anthrax screening, but postcards don't. And being part of protests. And then also, I wanted to add as a start, is to, for us in the United States, to start realizing that this next election in November and the one after that is really a one-issue election. It's either you're voting for democracy or you're voting for autocracy, because that's where we've gotten to in this country. Pettis, we have just a very short time, about 30 seconds.
About 30 seconds.
If that.
I won't ask a question then. No. I would just like to reinforce what you guys are talking about. The big stop for me is we need to stop parsing ourselves out of collectivity and really start uniting around issues where there is intersectionality, and it becomes more difficult because we keep parsing ourselves out.
Yeah.
So I say let's start looking for our common ground rather than what makes us different.
Dr. Kristen Leash and Anna DeWergulley, Pettis and I are so grateful that you found the time on this Mother's Day to join us on Be Bold America. I'm sorry, this hour just flew by. You both are doing such vital work, and thank you for being our bold and impressive guests today. We have big things to do, don't we?
Yes, thank you, Jill. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you, Anna. Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
Remember, Be Bold America is available as a podcast. Now you may listen to the show anytime for free wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give a special thank you to Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, to our station's program director, Howard Feldstein, and again to our bold Canadian friends, Dr. Kristen Leash and Anna DeWergulley, co-founders of Title Equality. Visit TitleEquality.com to learn more. You're listening to Be Bold America and KSQD Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide on KSQD.org. Stay tuned for Intersections with Seth Shapiro. My name is Jill Cody.
And I'm Dr. Pettis Perry.
Thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep stop start.